a World Health Organization report in February about the steps being taken against the coronavirus mentions where technologies like big data, AI, and cloud are being used to understand and fight the coronavirus and its spread. From December through February, 104 strains of COVID-19 were isolated from people in China who had contracted it, and the genome of the virus was sequenced, showing it was not SARS nor the flu, but a new disease. And the Chinese government deployed big data and artificial intelligence to track the spread of the virus within the country and to help identify risks for various populations. Researchers outside of China have been using machine learning to track the spread of the virus globally, sifting through huge amounts of data from news reports, social media, and flight patterns, just to name a few of the sources. Facebook is sharing data with Harvard researchers to help forecast the spread of the virus, and that's just an example of a few things that are going on behind the scenes. To talk about technology and combating this pandemic, we turn to David Shaywitz, co-host of Tectonics, a podcast on digital health. He got his MD at Harvard, PhD in biology from MIT, and most recently was a visiting scientist in the Department of Biomedical Informatics at Harvard Medical School, and he joins us now from his home in Silicon Valley. So David, just wanted to get some context on how technologies like AI and the cloud are being deployed, you know, from behind the scenes to deal with the coronavirus.
Sure, Jason. I mean, one of the initial responses you could say is, well, the fact that we're so deeply into this means that if the tech was so effective, we wouldn't be in this situation. So in some level, that's cheating and kind of getting to the bottom line. I think what a pandemic or what this situation, or really kind of any stress test, is a real challenge to a lot of the hype around technology and demands us to see, you know, what's real and what's promised, and also highlights both the opportunities for technology to make a difference as well as some of the limitations. So to sort of step through some of it, I think one of the first areas where technology, let's say AI, has played potentially a role, or at least it's been highlighted as playing a role, is in the area of surveillance. For example, there's a really interesting, actually, Toronto company. It's a B Corp company called Blue Dot, that is a sort of infectious disease surveillance company. And there are multiple organizations and groups and companies that try to do something like this, where it sort of monitors all of the world's news and then tries to incorporate that using a combination of manual curation and AI to try to highlight things that seem unusual and should be flagged for attention. So, for example, they were among the first in very late December to flag some unusual cases of pneumonia associated with a live market in Wuhan, China. Now, what I think is interesting about Blue Dot is it was actually founded by a physician entrepreneur and an ID doctor who had sort of gotten through the SARS epidemic in Toronto just under two decades before and really wanted to try to see if they could use technology. He wasn't intrinsically, he said, an entrepreneur. He just wanted to really try to figure out how to apply technology to this. He wound up working in a fashion that reminds me very much of the data company of Flatiron, where Flatiron is sort of an oncology data company that provides almost regulatory-grade data based on clinical information. And what their whole thing was integrating both, you know, digital and data and all of that stuff with manual curation. And in a very similar way, Blue Dot highlights really the importance of manual curation. And what they do is they have AI, you know, go do some of the translation, obviously, for, you know, all the world's languages, and they really integrate a lot of information that it would take human beings so long to go through. But ultimately, in terms of making the judgments, they essentially try to distill all of the information into kind of a couple of daily highlights, which then human curators sort of go through and try to see what might be interesting. In addition about that, Jason, is even though they sort of, you know, reported or had this finding, the impact of what they actually found on the world is at present unclear. So I think that surveillance is one area. Another area where it's, you know, people sort of highlight the potential is in drug development and or vaccine development. And again, the idea is that it's really, really difficult to make a drug from scratch. And almost everything that goes through the drug development pipeline as an idea does not come out the other end as a successful product. There's any number of reasons why generally very good ideas still don't have traction. You know, chemistry is incredibly complicated. Biology is really complicated. The human body is unimaginably complicated. And so it really turns out there's just a series of problems to solve. But there are some thoughts that the technology, you know, in AI and figuring out how proteins fold, trying to understand some toxicology, at some instances can potentially be modeled in certain steps, may be able to be accelerated. And so there are different companies that are sort of trying to work on that. But even if they sort of crack that in general, there are often so many other steps after that, that even if, you know, the thing with the new novel coronavirus, they just really figured it out what it was. It was amazing in the sense that they were able to get the, you know, genome sequence relatively soon after, you know, within a month or so of it being identified. And it takes a while to go from that, even that knowledge, okay, we have the genome, that's great, of this virus. How do you turn that into actionable information? Now, one company that may be doing this is a company called Moderna, which is trying to make vaccines. And they have a sort of a proprietary AI platform that they don't really share a lot about, that apparently tries to pick which aspects of the protein encoded by a gene is most likely to be most useful for something like a vaccine. But again, we're not really going to know. It's going to take a while to figure out if this works. And even though they're really moving almost unimaginably quickly, I mean, based on some of their work, turn was based on previous work because the new virus is similar to after the previous virus, they are actually expect to start clinical trials like in a year. And that's sort of, I mean, unimaginably fast for a vaccine.
And is that because of AI that they're able to move that quickly?
You know, it's really hard to tell. I imagine that they would say that they were able to pick out the specific at which to know what part of the virus to pick out and use for a vaccine was as a consequence of, you know, algorithms. And
I see. Let's actually not call it AI. Let's call it just big data, unstructured data, you know, that kind of thing.
Right.
How long have researchers been using big data and using analysis of unstructured data with computers to do research into genomes and viruses and bacteria? How long have they been actually using it, or is it still sort of an experimental thing?
Right. So if it's sort of two parts of the question, the genomics community has been on this really, really, really early, and they've been fairly early adopters of cloud, or at least some people have. But what confuses a lot of people about when you think about large organizations like pharmaceutical companies in particular is, on the one hand, they obviously are data-driven organizations and they have a lot of data. But big data is sort of almost, it says a little bit of a different meaning. Big data is much more sort of both comprehensive and it's all sort of, generally it's more interlocking. Whereas what you sort of wind up having is almost like the Minnesota model of data, where it's like land of 1,000 lakes. So there's a little bit of a lake here of data, a little bit of a lake there. And each of these lakes, to push the metaphor, are zealously guarded by whoever sort of owns or responsible by that data. I mean, their data is collected for a very specific purpose and it has intrinsic value in itself. But then the question is, can you sort of pull it? Is there value and how do you pull it together more effectively? And that's really where the industry is now. There's a general sense that, my gosh, how we're handling data in all these little silos doesn't make a lot of sense. And wouldn't it be great if we could pull this together in some useful way? And I think a lot of companies are struggling, you know, how to do that. And on the one hand, you know, the idea of what's really exciting for me to see is how things like the cloud, which used to be something that just made health people in particular really nervous. It was viewed as, oh no, we want to keep our data, you know, on our local server versus in the cloud somewhere. People finally have recognized that in many cases, you know, for the kind of the major providers in particular, the cloud is far more secure than having, you know, the data in sort of, you know, someone's personal data room or something.
Right.
So,
well, imagine all the data that you were saying, you know, it's kind of a people thing here in terms of the 10,000 lakes idea, but imagine if they could actually even get deeper into like flight manifests and actually know where people are. Of course, now you're getting into the privacy issue. Boy, it's very, very complex.
It's complicated, right? And I think they do have actually de-identified flight information there, and they do try to understand this. If you look at it, for all of this information, I was reading some article recently how they're trying to track the so-called patient zero. The basic assumption is that this new coronavirus originated from a bat somewhere, because I think that's where all these viruses eventually come from. Someone basically eats a bat, apparently, or a bat infects something that somebody eats. It turns out there aren't any bats near that market in Wuhan. The nearest bat is like a relevant bat somehow like 1,000 miles away. So, people are, going back, and it seems, the market was like, I guess, in December, but people are going back in November. And just trying to show you that it's really hard to track the very beginnings of something, where in theory where you might have been able to stop something. So it is really, what you're pointing out is so interesting, because on the one hand we have, at a population level, is incredibly rich information. But on an individual level, tracking down this very specific type of thing can be really, really hard. And then how do you turn this into something actionable? Like, so much of what I read about tech and AI is this could do this, or it may do this, or might do that. And it's like a combination of this urgent need with some promise, again, of what's going to happen. And I think the technologies are immensely powerful. So I think trying to kind of tone down the rhetoric and really try to come up with some very pragmatic use cases that deliver palpable benefit that people really can appreciate.
I guess one final line of questioning here, one final topic, and that is touching on something that you brought up a little earlier, which is what can be learned. I mean, the pandemic is on us. What do you think might happen as a result of all of the scrambling people are doing right now to do research and implement a lot of technologies?
Absolutely. Well, I think it's a great question. I think it is an opportunity. Exposure to stress both exposes fragility and has a chance to, for the organizations, the people, the processes that can learn from it, really helps robustify them and makes them sort of more able to deal with adversity. I actually think one area where we're really going to see this, how we're going to be coping with the, all the quarantines that are coming up. The two areas I'm thinking about involving technology are telecare and then all of the telecommuting stuff. So, and teleeducation.
Yeah, you don't really know if something can really work unless you're forced to have to do it.
Let me make two points about that. One specifically related to data, but the first point is, it's the famous quote, variously attributed to everyone from Caesar to Mike Tyson, that everybody has a strategy till they get punched in the face. And I think at a certain level that's true. But the flip of that...
Caesar said that, huh?
Yeah, well, something along those lines. But then the other thing what people say is, that's also so important about data. So what happens is, we were talking before about these large data lakes that then like turn out not to be that useful. And so what happens is, if you collect all your data with the idea that theoretically curious people could use it to answer anything, it's like theoretical, theoretical, theoretical. And then when people try to use it for practical reasons, it's like, oh, it doesn't really work that well. And that's why what seems to be much more effective is when you try to figure out what is your actual question you're trying to ask, and then really ask it and iteratively ask it. Because as you start to figure out what data you need, the goal is to try to do it as soon as you can. That's the whole, that's fundamentally how startups work, where they try to figure out, here, this is our working hypothesis, but let's actually try it. Talk to a customer.
Yeah, that reminds me of why the cloud has been so powerful lately for startups, because you don't have to put together a bunch of boxes for your data collection and then hire an IT team to oversee all of that.
100%. You've totally taken that off the table. Essentially, everybody can have unlimited, secure, safe compute everywhere, compute and storage everywhere. It's immensely liberating and empowering for startups. And that's how come all the startups use it.
Yeah. And so if you have an idea to do some vaccine research, you don't have to start a data center to go do it. You can just get AWS or wherever you want to go, and you're up and running.
Right. I mean, this is something, when I used to be chief medical officer at DNA Nexus, and it was just so conspicuously obvious there that access to the cloud is enormously empowering. And it was funny because even 5 years ago, there were a lot of medical centers that were like, oh, I don't know about the cloud. We're a little bit concerned. And now it's actually obvious that that's the safer place to go. There are different approaches to cloud, obviously. You know, sort of failing, it seems, almost sort of, it seems so clearly advantageous now that I think that the discussion has moved on to the next series of challenges.
David Shaywitz is a Harvard-trained medical doctor and scientist who co-hosts the podcast on digital health called Tectonics. He's also the founder of Astounding Health Tech, which advises biopharma companies engaged in research and development. There are all sorts of resources on the web regarding the coronavirus. If you want to see a real-time dashboard of the global spread of the pandemic, the Center for Systems Science and Engineering of Johns Hopkins University publishes one. It's in the notes accompanying the post of this podcast. This is the Tech Barometer Podcast. I'm Jason Lopez. Check out our other podcasts at theforecastbynutanix.com.